Hello and welcome to CJ Evolution, the podcast dedicated to helping criminal justice professionals like you. Now here's your host, fellow CJ Evolutionary, Patrick Fitzgibbons.
Hello everybody, welcome back. Episode 112, CJ Evolution. Patrick here, thank you for tuning in. Today we have a special guest on. His name is Dr. Gleb Sierpersky, and he is an avoidance disaster expert, and he teaches us how to avoid disasters through science-based decision-making and emotional and social intelligence. His expertise comes from being a scholar specializing in wise decision-making, emotional and social intelligence, goal achievement, meaning and purpose, mental health, and emotional well-being. Dr. Sierpersky has appeared on numerous TV, radio, podcasts, and videocasts. He's published just so many articles in prominent venues like Time, Psychology Today, and the Huffington Post. And he is a professor at The Ohio State University. I hope you enjoy this interview.
Thank you so much for having me on, Patrick. I appreciate it.
Well, we love having you on. I think having you on, I mean, I think it's very applicable to what criminal justice professionals do on a daily basis. What exactly is, I mean, I think the names in the answers in the title, can you elaborate a little more on what you do and how you help people avoid disaster?
Sure, happy to do so. So my expertise is in helping people make better decisions to avoid disasters. Disasters come about, the large majority of disasters come about as a result of bad decision making. Now, we can talk about external forces and so on, kind of external circumstances, but when you actually get down to it and you do the investigation on the disaster that occurred, really the disaster could have been avoided through better preparation, mm-hmm. even for external circumstances. And often, you know, in many other cases, it's just due to poor decision-making on the part of the person who is making the decision. So I study how people can make better decisions in business and in politics. That's kind of my focus. Mm-hmm. And how people can avoid disasters in those arenas. So I do a lot of, I'm a professor at Ohio State, so I research this professionally. I also do consulting for companies about this topic. So go in there, do presentations, consulting. I'm also a civic activist, and I focus on truth and rational thinking in politics and how we can avoid disaster in that area of politics and other areas of public discourse. Because often disasters and bad decisions come about because people have the wrong information, bad information, and criminal justice experts should know this better mm-hmm. than anyone, where bad information leads to bad decisions mm-hmm. and falsehoods and so on. So there is a proliferation of lies and deceptions in our public sphere, especially in our politics and so on, and that's something I try to address through my activism.
Now, how can people, speaking, you know, a little bit of what you brought up with, you know, kind of deception and lies in the public sphere, you know, politics and other areas, I mean, how can people decipher what is truth and what isn't, since we're on the topic?
Sure. So in deciphering what is true and what isn't, what I strongly orient toward is not, you know, telling people, hey, this is the truth and this is not. But my research suggests that what needs to happen is for people to agree on what are truth-oriented behaviors. You know, mm-hmm. it's like when a doctor says, hey, you need to lose weight. And you're like, well, what does that mean? What do I do to lose the weight? You know, my wife had that happen with a doctor, and she was really upset when she got home. She's like, I have no idea what I need to do. And so that's not good. Oh, yeah. What needs to happen, you know, it's easy to say, oh, lies are bad, but what does it actually mean in practicality?
That's a good point.
So
yeah.
That's what I've been researching with a big group of other behavioral scientists, how to address lies in politics. And we've come up with a set of 13 behaviors that actually define what it means to be oriented toward the truth. And for folks who are listening along and are by a computer, they can go to protruthpledge.org. Again, that's protruthpledge.org to check out these behaviors. And so these are behaviors such as, I'm going to read some. I'll strive to avoid sharing misinformation, even in service to a cause I believe is good. I'll aim to express myself in ways that clearly distinguish between what is my opinion and what are the facts. If my information is challenged, I'll make a reasonable effort to verify that it is true before repeating it and retract it if I cannot. I'll gladly celebrate those who retract incorrect statements and update their beliefs toward the truth. And 9 more behaviors. These are just 4 behaviors. Mm-hmm. So these behaviors give you very specific guidelines in the same way that, you know, when you want to lose weight, you do things like walk for, you know, 3 times or 4 times a week for at least 30 minutes and eat less calories in the evening than you would during the afternoon, because that's what the research shows, and so on. And so these are behaviors that are similarly, if you want to have a more truth-oriented society and more truth-oriented individuals, these are the 13 behaviors that's going to be valuable to follow. Mm-hmm. And so our aspiration, me and a group of other behavioral scientists, is to get all people, you know, whether they're ordinary citizens, whether they're major public figures, to take this pledge, the pro-truth pledge, and abide by it, and be public about taking it, and say, hey, I've taken this pro-truth pledge, and I'm sticking by these 13 behaviors. In the same way that if you want to lose weight, we would take, you know, take these behaviors and share with our friends about them. That's what we want to do, for people to take this pledge, share that they took it, and encourage others to take it. For public figures in particular, we have certain incentives to get them to take the pledge and a monitoring mechanism to hold them accountable after they took the pledge to make sure they stick by these behaviors.
I think it's good, very good information that you just shared with the listeners club. Now, certain things, I'm you're aware of this. I mean, certain disasters that we, you know, that come into our lives. I mean, some of it's unavoidable, right? I mean, a death or, you know, a car accident or something like that. I mean, some of that stuff you can avoid. But I really do. I think you really struck a chord with me, because it's a lot of it's just based on information. The more information we have, correct, the better decisions we can make.
Absolutely. And we can always prepare for disasters. So, for example, with death, right? We can, if someone, we can do things like get life insurance to protect ourselves against someone dying with us being unprepared for the financial consequences of this. Or with cars, you know, we can take care of our car and not, you know, go to a mechanic regularly and not just let it break down and hope it will be fine. Now, some disasters are not going to be avoidable. Any case, you know, for example, I had my bike recently. I was pedaling on my bike, and the bike pedal fell off. And I took it to a bike shop, and it was like, yeah, I mean, this couldn't have been avoided. This would just happen occasionally. You know, it's not something that can be caught if I take the bike to a bike shop regularly. But still, it's something that if I get do regular maintenance on my bike or my car or my health, it's something that's less likely to happen.
Sure.
So the goal of disaster avoidance is not to prevent disasters. You know, if you go to anyone, they can tell you, you can prevent all disasters, you know, run away. That's not going to happen. The point of disaster avoidance is to minimize disasters, minimize the possibility of disasters, and be ready to deal with them. So there's a really interesting book called The Black Swan about how people are unprepared for disasters and how to actually address disasters. And we can talk about that, but I'm going to take a stop, pause here and see what you have to say.
Interesting. Interesting. Yeah, I was thinking when you were talking, Doctor, about, and I agree with you, but, you know, I was thinking about that horrible, you know, this horrible terrorist attacks in London. And I was thinking, well, how do you can't avoid stuff like that. I mean, maybe with some of the decisions you're making when you're going through that just horrific incident, you know, maybe some of the decisions can avoid further disaster. But, I mean, those are things, obviously, you just can't avoid. People can't avoid.
Yes. With those disasters, you can't avoid the fact that it happened. Now, there are many ways that those disasters could have been addressed. Mm-hmm. So, for example, one of the reasons that Theresa May lost the election or didn't do nearly as well as she could have was because she, in her previous role as in her previous role before she headed the UK government, she cut down the police force in the UK, in London in particular. So that was something that people were upset about, that she cut down the police force, and now you have the attacks. And could the attacks have been prevented or dealt with better?
Sure.
If you had a bunch of police.
Nobody would know that.
Nobody would know that, but then you take a look back at the decision-making process. You know?
Sure.
So what were the decisions made beforehand? And so you can kind of prevent those in the future. That's one. Second, how do you respond to the attacks? So, for example, in France, when there were the terrorist attacks in Paris, the French president responded by kind of pretty aggressively blaming Muslims, painting Muslims with a broad brush for terrorist attacks. Now, is that really a wise response to paint Muslims with a broad brush? You know, if you look at the number of Muslims who are in France and the number of them who committed terrorist attacks, it's minuscule. It's something like 1 out of 200,000 commit terrorist attacks. What's the likelihood that a given Muslim will be a terrorist?
Sure.
Very low. And so if you paint the whole all Muslims with a broad brush, that radicalizes all of them and they inspire more terrorism. So that's pretty harmful as well. So
that's
you
a
can
good
also
point, yeah.
Yeah. So you can deal with things beforehand to protect yourself from disaster, and you can deal with things afterward to prevent disasters from happening.
Interesting. Now, so shifting a little bit to you know, the majority of listeners, criminal justice professionals,
yes.
How can you know, police officers, first responders, you know, I mean, and granted, you know, it's kind of a different, you know, a lot of times, you know, it's unavoidable. A lot of times, you know, disasters just come to us, but how can we make better decisions out there? How can we make better decisions on the street that where we can avoid, you know, certain disasters? And there's a myriad of them. I mean, but
sure,
and maybe it's kind of a broad question, but what can we do as first responders to make better decisions to avoid things?
Well, that's a good question. I do consult with police departments and things like this on how to address disasters. I haven't consulted with first responders and fire departments and ambulances, but I have consulted with police departments. And some of the things that I talk about has to do with my research on emotional intelligence and social intelligence in decision making. So it turns out that we have, what the research shows is that we have two systems of thinking. One of them is the autopilot system, which is the also known as system one, which is the automatic, intuitive, emotional system. It's our gut reactions. So that's a very powerful system, and it evolved in the savannah. That's the fight or flight response, very powerful. The other one evolved more recently. It's the intentional system of thinking. It's also called system two. And for people who want to read a longer description of it, they can read my works, or they can read Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow, a really good book. He's a Nobel Prize award winner who researches this stuff. So this system is more intentional, deliberative, and reflective. It takes a lot of effort to turn on. So it's slow. It takes, you know, if the autopilot system takes milliseconds to turn on, the intentional system takes about a second. So hundreds of times slower. And this is a system that overrides, it can override gut reactions and emotions, but only if we prepare for it in advance. So this is the key, where we need to figure out some systematic ways that our gut reactions and our emotions, our instincts go wrong, and then address those. For example, there's a lot of talk about implicit bias in police force.
Yeah, there is, yes.
Yes. And research shows that it is a real thing, so that black people are much more like, for example, let's talk about black people. Black people are about three times more likely to suffer from police violence at all levels, you know, from, you know, being handcuffed, tased, whatever, shot, to, at all levels, about three times more likely in similar situations as white people. Now, why is that? Well, the autopilot system, our intuitive and emotional system, which evolved in the savannah, it's very tribal. It's very intuitive. And so white police officers don't see black people as part of their tribe. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, criticizing white people. This is just a phenomenon. This is how our brains are wired. And if we don't realize this, if we're not honest with ourselves, we're not really going to be able to address the situation. So what happens in that situation when we are in a crisis, in emergency mode, any sort of first responder who sees a person who doesn't belong to his tribe will tend to have a less favorable response to this person. And that's known as the horns effect. So for folks who want to look it up, it's one of the many ways that our autopilot system goes wrong, the horns effect. So that if we see one person and we have a negative response to one aspect of that person, we see that person as negative in all other areas. So if we have a negative response to a person's color, gender, ethnicity, accent, clothing, we would tend to think that person is more likely to be guilty of a crime or otherwise mm-hmm. a bad behavior. So what I advise for police departments when I do this is to, for police officers to do what's called in the research of considering the alternative when they see someone who is not like them, and give that person more positive intuitive evaluation than they would otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
So to override their emotional intuitive system. Again, not blaming people for these emotional intuitive systems, but they need to override that. It's called a de-anchoring strategy, de-anchoring mm-hmm. from our current intuitions and habits. So to override that, we need to have more positive emotions toward this person. And this is something I train police departments on quite regularly, how to have more positive emotions toward these people and have better responses toward them.
Now, the one thing that, and you're right, I mean, implicit bias, that type of a training is becoming more and more prevalent in law enforcement agencies across the country, and I think it's good. We need to come to grips with this. But I was thinking, what would you say? You have an African American police officer.
African American police officers are also have this implicit bias, according to studies. I was surprised when I first saw these studies,
mm-hmm.
but to a lesser extent, they also have this bias because of cultural stereotypes.
Okay.
They have an association with, you know, African Americans are quote unquote bad, somehow negative. So we need to distinguish two things. We need to distinguish a certain reality that African Americans, according to studies, according to research, are more likely to commit crimes. Now, it doesn't mean that African Americanness is in any way associated with criminality. It's just that African Americans tend to come from a lower socioeconomic background by comparison to the, you know, white people, and people from a lower socioeconomic background do tend to commit more crimes. So yes, there is a reason to be slightly more suspicious of African Americans. So that is the case.
But I work in an environment that is very affluent, and you know, one can make the argument that, you know, that, you know, crimes, I mean, because I think sometimes, I mean, we, you know, people kind of say, well, you know, this person's on the lower socioeconomic ladder,
mm-hmm.
they're going to commit crime. I've seen wealthy people, I've seen middle class people commit all kinds of crimes, and maybe just because of the environment I work in. But
of course you have. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised that you have. It's all about statistics.
Mm-hmm.
So statistically speaking, you know, is it reasonable to have more of a suspicion of African Americans? Now, statistically speaking, when we see that African Americans tend to commit more crimes because they come from a lower socioeconomic background, yes. I mean, I want to make sure that I am communicating very clearly.
Mm-hmm.
There is a correlation between being African American and committing more crimes. Now, that doesn't mean that white people or wealthy people will not commit crimes. They'll certainly commit crimes.
Sure.
But there will be less of them. And so, but the actual, when you correct for the number of crimes committed by African Americans, in studies that correct for the amount of crimes committed by African Americans, they are still about three times more likely. And the number of crimes committed by African Americans is something, I don't remember the statistics, something like 20 to 30% more. But they are still, when you correct for the amount of crimes, they're still about three times more likely to suffer police violence
mm-hmm.
of various sorts. It's an irrational response to African Americans. So there's nothing, again, essential about being African American committing crimes. It's about the culture that one is raised in associated with lower socioeconomic status. So if you find wealthy African Americans compared to wealthy, same amount of wealth of white people, I would guess that they would probably commit crimes at about the same level.
Mm-hmm.
This is an intuitive assumption. I don't have statistics to back this up. So whenever I have statistics, I clearly say I have statistics. When I don't, I don't.
Mm-hmm.
But so this is what my guess would be.
Now, how can we, Doctor, make better decisions in terms of, I think you hit on it at the beginning a little bit, but maybe money and relationships, kind of the same, you know, stuff that goes back to what you were talking about, the behavioral science behind it, right?
Yes. So here it's really important to figure out what cognitive bias is. So cognitive biases is the systematic errors that are, especially our autopilot system tends to make, the intentional system tends to make some of them as well. So some of the systematic errors that our autopilot system tends to make. And so here are a number of them. One of them is sunken costs. When we invest our efforts into something, we are more likely to keep putting money into it. This applies to all areas of life. You know, when we have a car that we invest a lot of money into, then we are irrationally going to invest more money into it, even if it would make more sense to buy a new car. Or if we invest a lot of efforts, you know, in the criminal justice profession into investigating a suspect, we will tend to keep investigating the suspect, even if it makes more sense to investigate someone else, just because we put a lot of effort and time into the suspect and we just don't want to let it go, even though we might have evidence that the suspect hasn't actually done whatever we may suspect the suspect of having done. So that's the sunken cost effect. And it has to do with our autopilot system getting emotionally attached to the amount of effort and time and money that we put into something and not wanting to let it go, even if it's irrational to put more effort and money into it. So that's kind of, you know, same thing with relationships. People tend to put a lot more efforts into relationships than those relationships are worth. When we should, you know, have gotten out of them a long time ago.
Which might explain the high divorce rate, doctor, in this country.
Yes, absolutely. So that's kind of one. Another error is overconfidence. So overconfidence is a huge one. You know, when people say that they are 99% sure of something, research shows that only 80% of the time are they correct about the thing.
True.
You know, this is something that Las Vegas makes a lot of money on.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good point. Yeah, that's a good point.
But also, you know, it makes a lot of problems for our financial decisions when we invest into something. We're definitely sure this thing is going to pan out, and no,
or,
it's not.
Or we do something out of just purely out of emotion, right? I mean, where we make decisions. We're not kind of making a rational decision, but we're making an emotional decision.
Absolutely. So this is kind of one of those things. The same thing applies in, you know, all sorts of criminal justice, you know, first responder situations when we feel very sure that something is the case and then it doesn't pan out. So this is a big problem, overconfidence. Mm-hmm. And so each person needs to figure out how overconfident she or he is in something and their own level of overconfidence and then scale that down to correct for their overconfidence. And that, there's a good way of calibrating that, which is basically assigning numbers to your probability of confidence and then seeing how often it pans out. So let's say, you know, you say something like, oh, I'm 90% sure that that's going to be the case. Mm-hmm. And then it turns out that it's the case only 70% of the time. Then you got to figure out, okay, you're 25% overconfident or something like that. And then decrease your probability of confidence by that amount.
Now, go ahead. I'm sorry, doctor.
Yeah, so that is a quite effective strategy of ensuring that we make better decisions by calibrating ourselves and figuring out our degree of overconfidence in general.
Now, to what? Yeah, I talk about this sometimes on the show. You know, I think a lot of our decision making, maybe sometimes comes from the people around us. I mean, what's your take on that? I mean, how influenced are we by our circle, the people around us?
We're quite influenced by the circle of people around us. So it's quite powerful. There's a phenomenon called network effects where people are quite strongly impacted by what people around them do. So for example, if someone around you loses weight, then you're more likely to lose weight. If someone gains weight, you're more likely to gain weight. Someone stops smoking, same thing, and starts smoking. Divorce. All of these things are influenced by people in our social circle to some extent or other. And so what I tend to do and what I tend to recommend people to do is to make sure that they are intentional about who they surround themselves with.
Exactly.
And choose to surround yourself with people that you want to be like, rather than random people.
Exactly.
Because you will be influenced by them, even if you don't realize it.
And they might be good people. They might, you know, be family, you know, close friends. But if they're influencing you, that could push you into the disaster, like you're talking about.
Absolutely.
You know,
it can push you into making really bad decisions.
Yeah,
and it can be harmful for you. So yes, limiting your time and your emotional investment with people who are not healthy for you, who are not making good decisions, is quite beneficial.
So, doctor, how can we find meaning and purpose? Because a lot of my show, as I talk about, you know, criminal justice issues and topics, which are very important, but I also talk about other things. But how do we find meaning? How do we find purpose, you know, vision, mental and emotional well-being using science-based strategies?
Yeah, this is something that I talk about quite a bit. And I wrote the book called Find Your Purpose Using Science, which folks can check out on Amazon and elsewhere. So again, Find Your Purpose Using Science. It talks about, first of all, the benefits of finding meaning and purpose, a strong sense of meaning and purpose. And the research shows that people who lack a strong sense of meaning and purpose have poor physical health. They have more strokes, more heart disease, more stomach ailments, and all sorts of other problems.
Mm-hmm.
They also have less mental well-being. So they have more anxiety, more depression, more risky behavior, all sorts of problems. You know, no criminal justice expert should want that, or anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are four things that research shows are really important for finding a sense of meaning and purpose. And, well, first of all, defining a sense of meaning and purpose, that's the overarching drive that gets you out of bed in the morning and gets you out and doing things.
Mm-hmm.
Something that really is something you're passionate about. And so it's important, the first step is to figure out what is your sense of meaning and purpose. What are you passionate about? What gets you out of bed in the morning? And then connect it to your everyday activities. So, you know, for people who are, let's say, criminal justice experts, you know, is it finding the truth? Is it making sure that criminals aren't out and about and harming society? Or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe it's spending time with your family in some kind of really meaningful and deep way. So figure that out and connect it to your everyday activities. Then the next one is reflection. So reflect, spend some time journaling or doing, you know, talking about it or other forms of self-reflection or reflection with others on how your everyday activities contribute to your sense of meaning and purpose. So the first has to do with actual connection. Second has to do with awareness.
Mm-hmm.
So this awareness is also really important for cultivating a strong sense of meaning and purpose. Third is community. So community bonds, community belonging has been shown by research to be quite strongly correlated with a deep sense of meaning and purpose. And third is serving something other outside of yourself. So whether it's charity, whether it's, you know, volunteering, whether it's through your job, which gives you a certain sense of serving others, and a lot of criminal justice experts certainly do that, something that helps you have the internal sensation that you are serving something outside of yourself is going to be quite important. And in the book, Find Your Purpose Using Science, I go through strategies for developing all of those.
Mm-hmm.
So, but those are the four key things.
So important, doctor. Now, the one thing that really, and it's all important, and I love it. Why is journaling, from a scientific point of view, why is that so? Because I hear this a lot, and you just kind of reaffirm that. Why is it so important that we put pen to paper?
Journaling is quite important because it helps us connect. It helps us have self-awareness. So, you know, we might be doing the things that cause us to have meaning and purpose. But if we're not self-aware of it, we're not going to cultivate the deep sense of meaning and purpose that we should have based on our activities. So journaling is about gaining self-awareness of who we are. You know, there's a lot of ancient philosophy that talks about, you know, the hardest thing to do is be self-aware. And it's pretty true. Self-awareness is really difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And when we journal, we become more aware of who we are and what we're doing. And we draw our attention to certain aspects of ourselves that we want to build up. It's personal development, personal growth. That's also, you know, another aspect of it. For example, a research-based strategy for, you know, something that's been proven for, by a number of studies, is that having a gratitude diary will increase your level of happiness. So that means something like writing down every day, or, you know, every couple of times a week, the things that you're grateful for that day, that week, or something like that. So I do it daily. It depends on your personal preference when you do it. And that is something that has been shown by research to increase your happiness. And, you know, who wouldn't want that, right? Mm-hmm. It's counterintuitive that it does so, but it does so because it draws our attention to this.
Sure.
It makes us more self-aware of how good our life is.
Amazing. Well, Doctor, if people want to reach out to you, how do they find you, sir?
They can email me at Gleb, G-L-E-B, at intentionalinsights.org. Again, that's Gleb at intentionalinsights.org. Intentional Insights at intentionalinsights.org is the nonprofit that I help, where I serve as the volunteer president and where I publish a lot of my articles, and other folks who do the same things as I do publish their articles. If they are interested in my consulting and other aspects of disaster avoidance, they can check out disasteravoidanceexpert.com. Again, that's disasteravoidanceexpert.com. That talks about my speaking and consulting. So if anyone wants me to speak or consult for your police department or anything like that, you can find me there. And if you're interested in the Pro-Truth Pledge to fight lies and deception in our public discourse, that's at protruthpledge.org. And I invite everyone to take 2 minutes to fight lies and deception in our public discourse by going to protruthpledge.org and signing up for the pledge.
Well, Dr. Sapersky, I appreciate you being here. Professor at Ohio State University, thank you for taking the time, sir.
Sure. Thank you very much, Patrick.
All right, Gleb. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to CJ Evolution. Be sure to head over to iTunes and rate and review the podcast, and reach out to Patrick on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Anchor, or Snapchat. We'll see you next time on CJ Evolution.